I wanted to consider, address a phenomenon today, which it seems to me is everywhere around us. And it is a very negative spiritual situation. Over the course of my lifetime, it has become more and more common in our society. Since God's church lives and functions in this society, and I'll talk a little bit more about that, it is something we need to be on guard against. So today I want to consider the spiritual problem of comparative justification. And I would submit to you, this is something, as with every other kind of leavening, that we should be getting out of our lives as we approach the days of unleavened bread. Now, we cannot, of course, address every kind of leavening as we approach the days of unleavened bread, but this is a piece of leavening, I think, that is over some period of time since I've been in the church, become more and more a problem within the church. And I'm anticipating that because of the way that society has developed and continues to be developed, it's probably going to continue to increase as a problem within the church. So we have a chance ourselves. We can't address the situation with everybody, everywhere, but at least within ourselves and among ourselves, I'd like to address the problem today of comparative justification. And I'd like to address as well the time in which we should be working to get that out of our lives. So I put down here the specific purpose statement: to consider during the next 5 days comparative justification, and to remove that leaven from our lives now. We have a very specific chronology that was given to us in the Bible about getting leaven out of our lives and out of our houses. Now, the Passover is this Thursday at sunset, but the Passover day continues until sunset on Friday. Here is what we are to do in regard to that leaven. We are to have the leaven out of our houses by sundown Friday, the 6th of April. This is at the end of the Passover day. Immediately following that is the night to be much observed. So we can still, not necessarily saying you have to, but you are still allowed to have leavening in your house on the Passover day. I would speculate maybe as to why that is. Well, when is it that the leavening can really leave our lives? It was after the sacrifice of Christ was completed. And the sacrifice of Christ was completed on the Passover day, just at the beginning of the night to be much observed. This week, this festival, by the way, will have you might consider a double Sabbath, because the first day of unleavened bread, which is a high holy day, is also on the weekly Sabbath. So it's a Sabbath for two reasons. It's a Sabbath because it is Saturday. But all of the high holy days, the Bible tells us in Leviticus 23, are also Sabbath days. And so we will have a double Sabbath. In Estonia, when I encountered some people there who were keeping it for the first time, they had a special word for it. It was a great Sabbath. And so this coming Sabbath will be a great Sabbath. Before Friday night, we should have all of the leaven off of our property. Plan your disposal. I have some bad experiences when I did not plan my disposal appropriately. One time I decided, well, I've got to go somewhere in Elmira, and I knew where there was this dumpster outside of a restaurant along the way, and so I had my leavening in my vehicle. I pulled into the back of this restaurant, got out of my car, and went over and dropped my bag of leavening into the dumpster. Just as I did, I heard a very irate voice behind me saying, "This is our dumpster. You don't have the right to put your garbage in our dumpster. We have to pay for this." And of course, I was embarrassed, and I had to go climb down in the dumpster, get my garbage out, and then find another place to take the garbage. So it's important to plan that you get your garbage taken to a place where there is an appropriate disposal. I remember, of course, Ken Swisher, I've told some of you this before, had found leavening in his freezer that he had overlooked during the days of unleavened bread. And now he had to get rid of that, and he grabbed it, and he was so diligent and so upset by the fact that he had overlooked this leavening when he took it out of his house. It was now like the third day of unleavened bread. He grabbed it and ran as hard as he could to the back of his property, threw it over the fence into his neighbor's yard. When he did that, he went back to the house, but the neighbor's dog found the bag of, I guess it was hamburger rolls or something. And I guess they had by this time thawed out a bit, and the dog dragged them back into his yard and scattered them all over his yard. So now he had a much bigger cleanup job. And he said the lesson he learned out of that was it's not appropriate to be throwing your sin on somebody else's property. You have to dispose of it properly. So plan your disposal. Seven days, we are to eat unleavened bread. This starts at sundown Friday, the 13th of April, the 6th of April, and continues until sundown on the 13th of April. 7 days we are to eat unleavened bread. And I really emphasized that in the last sermon. I think we are to eat unleavened bread every one of those 7 days. And it starts with a night to be much observed. I can tell you another story, I guess. When we were in Estonia, pretty much one of the earliest festivals that we kept there during the days of unleavened bread, we had made reservations at a restaurant. And I think we had clearly instructed the people in the restaurant. Yes, Hazel's back there shaking her head. We had clearly instructed the people in the restaurant, no bread. So we arrived there just about sunset. We had two snafus. The people in the restaurant came and put there were about 15 or 20 of us there, big baskets of bread on the table. And so we asked them to please remove the bread. But then where's our unleavened bread that we were going to bring unleavened bread? We had forgotten to bring the unleavened bread. So in those days, Bryant was a little more capable of running than he is now. I sent him running back to the hotel, and he got a couple of boxes of unleavened bread, you know, matzos, and ran back to the restaurant with them. So that kind of emphasizes the cutoff point at which we need to have unleavened bread at the start of the night to be much observed. And no leavening at that time. Exodus chapter 12, verse 15. 7 days, Sibiyam, shall you eat unleavened bread. Even the first day you shall put away leaven out of your houses. Whosoever eats leavened bread from the first day until the seventh day, that soul shall be cut off from Israel. And as I said, I've made that mistake before, and fortunately, I didn't get cut off from Israel. And I don't think it's talking about somebody who makes a mistake, but somebody who intentionally violates this particular thing. Just for emphasis, if you look down in Exodus chapter 12 and verse 20, you shall eat nothing leavened. In all your habitation shall you eat unleavened bread. So I hope that makes the chronology for us very specific and well understood. Any questions about that chronology, then ask us following services. Eating unleavened bread and not eating leavened bread is, Paul explains to us, there are two principles involved in that. And so I will explain those two principles here for the next several minutes. Leavening for 7 days symbolizes M&W, malice and wickedness. That's what leavening doesn't symbolize it today or tomorrow, but during this 7-day period, when you're to have it out of your houses and offer your property and not to eat it, it symbolizes during this festival malice and wickedness. 1 Corinthians chapter 5 and verse 7. Is it about bread? Is bread the really important thing? Or is bread a symbol which helps us to understand what we're doing? Does it give us the reminder that we need? And does God give us that reminder because we are physical and we need to be doing certain physical things in order to keep us in mind of the spiritual things? 1 Corinthians chapter 5, verse 7. Purge out, therefore, the old leaven that you, not so that your house is going to be okay and so forth, it is you that is being emphasized here in this scripture from Paul. You may be a new lump. Are you a lump? Well, that's the analogy that Paul is drawing here. You know, you take a little bit of flour and mix it together and so forth. It's a lump. It's a lump of dough. Then when you introduce leavening into it, typically at that time it would have been yeast. We have other things with which we leaven bread now. But you, not bread, you, may be a new lump as you are unleavened. What it says here, as you are unleavened, not as the bread is unleavened. You're going to be eating the bread, It says do it for 7 days, but it says you are to be really what is being unleavened. For even Christ, our Passover, is sacrificed for us. Verse 8. Let us keep the feast, not with old leaven. Again, this is all personal. It's all being emphasized as a personal thing. Not with old leaven, neither with the leaven of... Here's the thing where the symbolism stands out for us, and a place where we see the explanation of what leavening means. Not with the old leaven, neither the leaven of malice and wickedness. Malice, the leaven of malice and wickedness. That's one of the principles, one of the two principles. I wanted to emphasize to you here that leaven stands for malice and wickedness. You see, it right here in this scripture. Now, Paul is identifying the symbols of this festival. As an aside, I'll point out to you here that for many who argue that the holy days are not to be kept, Paul is teaching a church, a Gentile church, in the year 55 AD, how it is they are to keep the Feast of Unleavened Bread. It's an instruction. There's no way to read this book and not see that he is instructing those people about how it is they are to keep the days of unleavened bread. 55 AD, that's, 25 years after the death of Christ, close to it. Acts 10 had already occurred, here Paul is talking to, or Acts 15, I guess it is, where the conference was held discussing what things the Gentiles need to be taught. Here Paul is teaching this Gentile church years later that they are to keep the days of unleavened bread. And he's teaching them what the symbols of leaven are, and principle number two, what the unleavened bread symbolizes as well. Finishing that verse of Scripture, verse 8, you keep the feast with the unleavened bread of sincerity and truth. So he's contrasting those two things. Leavened bread stands for malice and wickedness during this festival. Unleavened bread during this festival symbolizes sincerity and truth. The two are contrasted. During this festival, we are not to be really dealing with the leavening. We should be dealing with the leavening leading up to the festival. And once we get to the festival, that which should already have been done maybe leaves a void in our lives, and now we should put into our lives sincerity and truth. And we should be focused during that festival not on getting out the leaven. It should have been out already. Malice and wickedness should have been out before the festival started. We should be focusing on building sincerity and truth into our lives for the period of that festival. That's how I put down here, amalgamate the principle of the meanings of the two with the chronology. The chronology says get it out ahead of time. What is it going to represent? It should be gone ahead of time. And so if you amalgamate the chronology and the principles, then it should be gone before that. And we should be using the subsequent 7 days to build good spiritual habits. For that reason, I think it's not really appropriate to go through that festival and choose days when you might not eat unleavened bread, because I think we are to be eating unleavened bread. That is, we are to be learning principles of sincerity and truth every one of those days. And there's not a day when we could sort of not do that. So the spiritual opposite of malice and wickedness is sincerity and truth. Okay, let's progress a little bit further here and consider comparing. Because I said I want to address the problem, which is a kind of leaven that we should have out of our lives before we get to the days of unleavened bread. It's not unique. You know, we're to have all the leavening out of our lives before the days of unleavened bread. That's a big job, isn't it? Can't address all the things that we have to get out of our lives. But I can take this maybe as a sample, and you can look at what things that you feel are important to you that you need to get out of your lives. Once a member of the church was not happy about one of my sermons, can you imagine that anybody ever would not be? But he came and said, I think you're speaking to us about your own problem. And I said, yeah, I was. You know, and I said, I'll tell you something else. I don't think it's unusual for the minister to speak to the congregation about something he identifies in himself as his problem. And so, do I have the problem? Yes, I do. Does everybody else have the problem? Well, maybe you don't. But I think it's a pretty pervasive problem, and it's one that is becoming even more profound in our society day by day. Comparative justification. I'm 70, so I have a panorama that a lot of you may not have looking back, and I can see how this has changed over the years. And I know the church is a part of this world. And so I think it's only normal that we could see it creeping into the world. And one of the things is it's been a technological revolution in the last 10 or 15 years, which has really led to this occurring. Here's the way Paul describes the end of this age. And I would submit to you that you can see all of the elements of comparative justification in this description, although he doesn't use that terminology here. But if you think about what comparative justification is and analyze it a bit, I think you can see all of the elements of it in here. 2 Timothy chapter 3, starting in verse 1. In the last days, and I think every one of us would understand that the time period we're living in is the last days, as the Bible describes them, the last days of this present evil age, perilous times will come. And there is a litany here that he gives. Men shall be lovers of their own selves, covetous, boasters, proud, blasphemers, disobedient to parents, unthankful, unholy, without natural affection, truce breakers, false accusers, incontinent, fierce despisers of those that are good, traitors, heady, high-minded, litany of things, lovers of pleasure more than lovers of God. In this analysis, I think, in this litany of characteristics, I think you will see manifested a lot of accusation, a lot of comparison, and a lot of finger-pointing being talked about. I think those are all elements of comparative justification. I think all of this that we read there about what the end of this age will be like is akin to and related to comparative justification. What is the common root? Well, of all of these things that you look at here, M and W, malice and wickedness. I wouldn't say you couldn't make a case for a lot of other kinds of malice and wickedness in here, but I would think that if you read this and you think about what comparative justification is, comparing to others and blaming them for what you might see them doing, and usually there is a purpose behind it. I'll get into that a little bit more. I wouldn't say that you can't find a case here for other kinds of malice and wickedness besides comparative justification. But I think that this does certainly encompass, this list of characteristics certainly does encompass comparative justification. The common root, malice and wickedness, springs from, I think, self-aggrandizement or pride. Pride. A little leaven leavens the whole lump. You can take just a little bit of dough, and if you get the leaven in there, you know, and you let it work for a while, then you have a nice, puffy, big roll. And that's what it's saying about you and I. If we get these wrong kinds of spiritual characteristics in ourselves and we let them ferment, and that's what yeast does, isn't it? It ferments. It actually consumes sugar, produces CO2, and the CO2 bubbles the bread up. The indication being that you and I can be blown up by having this leavening in us. And, you know, the symbolism of pride is puffed up. We are puffed up. And that's what it's saying here. A little bit of leaven leavens the whole lump. And this malice and wickedness that we read about there in 2 Timothy, it is just a manifestation of all of these different kinds of spiritual characteristics that come from the common root of pride, leaven. So God says, get the leaven out. This is an element of that leaven. Now, I'd say that these scriptures are not necessarily primarily to warn us that we have these kind of things in the church. They're primarily to warn us about what the world is going to be like. That's what it says here, isn't it? That in the last days, talking about the world in general, but since we are not able to be completely separate from the world, we have to guard ourselves against that which comes into us, comes into our midst from the world. I read this scripture, and of course I'll be reading it on, I expect to be reading it on the Passover. John chapter 17 and verse 14. It is Christ's prayer just before he's taken to be crucified. He's praying to God the Father. He says, I have given them your word. And you know what? It is what it is. We wish it wasn't, but it is what it is. If we have Christ's word, the world's not going to feel very good toward us. I have given them your word. The world hates them because they are not of the world. It separates you and makes you different from the rest of the world. And if you are different from the rest of the world, you're not going to be very well received or loved. That's just the way it is. Goes with the territory. I do not pray that you should take them out of the world. You know, we We're in a world, as I say, where we're going to find more. We have found more and more, and I would submit to you, we're going to continue to find additionally more and more comparative justification. I do not pray that you should take them out of the world. Be nice if we could be out of the world. At least it would be easy, but I presume that God the Father and Jesus Christ have determined it would not be the most spiritually beneficial thing for you and I if we were taken out of the world. But that you should keep them from the evil. I could elaborate a little bit about what I understand comparative justification to be. Just to justify. Let's start with that word, justify. What does it mean when we say to justify or justification? It means to make clean. That's what the word means, to make clean, to clear, or to declare righteous. Now that's something that's really important and really good, isn't it? We all need to be justified. And there has been a method provided for us by which we can be justified. But it's not by doing something on our own to bring it about. Comparative justification then is used in an attempt to justify, I may use it in an attempt to justify myself when there may be some need. You know, and I think typically this is done by pointing the finger. I can point the finger at Hazel and say, I might have done something, but she did something even worse than I did. So if I can focus the attention on her for having done something worse, comparatively speaking, than I did, then I take the attention away from myself. It's an attempt to make myself justified by accusing or pointing at someone else. There's been a lot of that. Goes on in many different situations. I thought about talking about the world and how this is apparent in the world. In the political world of today, this is practically the whole method by which politics are presently conducted. You know, I'm looking at the Republican primary and thinking about it. They're all trying to be more conservative than the other guy. All of the candidates are trying to be the most conservative candidate. And so somebody points out part of their record that isn't conservative and asks them about it. And typically it's to say, well, what about such and such other candidate? Look at what he did. And that's, again, comparing to justify what they did. We might call it mudslinging. And it seems to be the most prevalent way that it's conducted. I would say this is a big temptation among our children as well. And it's something that we need to work with our children, because it just seems to come naturally that one child would accuse the other child whenever the first child has done something he shouldn't have done. And so it's something that we need to identify as parents and teachers, and tell them that this is not acceptable. It's not an acceptable way to behave. If you go on, and this is one of my feelings about the internet as a whole. If you go on the internet and you Google virtually anything, you will find all kinds of accusations and false finger pointing. That doesn't necessarily mean that it isn't partially true, but there is this kind of comparative justification that goes on all over the internet. And I think it's a very devastating thing, not necessarily strictly for the church in which we reside, but for our society as a whole. And to the extent that we let this come into the church and we participate in it, which sometimes has happened, then we are not doing as we should, and that could be some of the leaven we need to think about and consider getting out of our lives. I would say we shouldn't listen to, pass on, or add to any of that sort of thing. We become a participant in the evil. 2 Timothy chapter 3 and verse 5. I would argue that this scripture applies. We were reading 2 Timothy 3, verses 1 through 4, and we saw a litany of those things. Here's what Paul concludes with. I intentionally postponed it till we get to this point. He says that there are those who have a form of godliness, but they deny the power. And he says, from such, turn away. Turn away. How do we turn away? Well, we turn away by not listening to it, by not passing it on, and by not adding to any of that sort of thing. First century church. Paul addresses comparing there in that church in Corinth. 2 Corinthians chapter 10, verse 12. We dare not make ourselves of the number or compare ourselves with some that commend themselves, but they measuring themselves by themselves and comparing themselves among themselves are not wise. It just smacks of what Paul was seeing in that church, comparative justification, and which can grow into and become a problem in our church. Now here, I'm not exactly sure what it means, we dare not make ourselves of the number. I surmise, I might be incorrect about this, but it seems like they were taking sides and seeing how many people were supporting Paul and how many people were supporting somebody else in the church. You know, it's like a political arena where people were lining up on one side or the other side. And if you read the context here, you will find that they were saying that Paul was really kind of a wimp and not very good. And he writes good letters, but when he's here, he's just a wimp and a weakling. And so then they were divided. The church was dividing, I would surmise here, by comparing, and in particular comparing, some of the leaders in the church were apparently comparing themselves with Paul. Don't do that. Again, teaching our children not to justify themselves by comparison. Jackson and Mason really haven't been too prone to do that. I don't know why. They must have taken after their grandpa instead of their grandma. I know better than that. I'm just I'm just being a comparative justifier myself right there. They have some cousins, though, that have been prone to take this tactic whenever they're with us against their own brothers and also against Mason and Jackson. And so it's a thing that I know, and of course I did it when I was a child. Everybody, I think, who has been a child, if you haven't been a child, stand up. Everybody who's been a child probably has participated at one time or another in this tactic. So I think it's a really important thing for us to be teaching our young people. Because I think I'm just of the opinion, given the internet, given the world that we live in, and given the spiritual deterioration which is occurring, it's gonna get worse and worse. This is Isaiah 58 is the fast chapter. Chapter about fasting. And it talks about two things in this chapter. One is the kind of fast that God will not hear or honor. It also talks about the kind of fast that God will hear. Isaiah chapter 58 and verse 9. You shall call, and the Lord will answer. You shall cry, and He shall say, Here I am. That's what we want, isn't it? Isn't that what we want? If, there's that big word, if you take away from the midst of you the yoke, the putting forth of the finger, and the speaking of vanity. Something to focus on. Continuing in verse 10, if you draw out your soul to the hungry, satisfy the afflicted soul, then shall your light rise in obscurity and your darkness be as the noonday. So that's what we want to be aiming at. That's what we want to be working on, looking at in our own lives, and trying to accomplish spiritually. One of the most important examples of comparative justification in the Bible is King Saul. King Saul. He resorted to pointing his finger to deflect the blame from what he had done. 1 Samuel chapter 15. Verse 13. Samuel came to Saul. Now God had instructed Saul very specifically about what to do. And Saul mostly did it. But partly he didn't do it. He came to Saul, and Saul said to him, Blessed be you of the Lord. I have performed the commandment of the Lord. Well, the commandment of the Lord was utterly kill all of the sheep, the oxen, and so forth of the Amalekites. Totally kill all of those animals. At least in part. Samuel says, Oh, well, you have done the commandment of the Lord. What means then this bleating of the sheep in mine ears and the lowing of the oxen which I hear? What is all of this noise I hear from the pens where the animals are? If you did exactly as God said, then Saul said, Point the finger and said, They brought them from the Amalekites. The people. He's shifting this blame from himself to others. the people spared the best of the sheep and of the oxen to sacrifice unto the Lord your God. You, we knew you wanted to, so you're kind of involved in this too, Samuel. You like sacrifices, and so we saved the best, so you could have something to sacrifice. So it's partly, I mean, you're sharing in the responsibility for this, aren't you, Samuel? But the rest, we utterly destroyed. In other words, the ones who weren't really worth keeping all that much or taking back to Israel, we utterly destroyed those. Samuel said to Saul, "Stay, and I will tell you what the Lord has said to me this night." And so Samuel said, "Say on," he was hoping, I guess, even still at this point, for something positive to be said about him from God. "When you were little, unleavened." You know, once you're leavened, you aren't little anymore. You're puffed up. And you have a sense of pride from which comes all kind of malice and wickedness. "When you were little in your own sight, you were made the head of the tribes of Israel, and the Lord anointed you to be king over Israel. The Lord sent you on a journey and said, 'Go and utterly destroy the sinners, the Amalekites, and fight against them until they be consumed.'" He said, "Why didn't you obey the voice of the Lord?" Question. Why didn't you obey the voice of the Lord? There's a couple of things here. You know how absolutely important it is to completely obey all of the instructions of God. There's just a lesson here about how important it is to completely obey every part of an instruction that God gives us. Why didn't you obey the voice of the Lord? He did do a lot of the things that God said, just not all of them. "But you did fly upon the spoil." See, so Samuel says, you're saying the people did it, and they saved them, and you were providing me with animals to sacrifice, but no. He says, "You were flying upon the spoil and did evil in the sight of the Lord." Saul said to Samuel, "Oh, I obeyed the voice of the Lord, and I have gone the way which the Lord sent me, and I brought Agag, the king of the Amalekites." You see, he didn't put Agag to death as he'd been commanded to do. "And have utterly destroyed the Amalekites. But the people. It's somebody else's fault here for what was done. "Took of the spoil of the sheep and the oxen, the chief of the things which should have been destroyed, to sacrifice unto the Lord." He was depending on self-justification. Now, after he had not obeyed the voice of the Lord, I don't know that if he had not been involved in finger-pointing and self-justification, that he wouldn't have gotten the same result. But you can see here, this is one of the real examples, and you see what the result was. Samuel said, verse 22, "Has the Lord as great delight in burnt offerings and sacrifices as in obedience? Behold, to obey is better than sacrifice, and to hearken than the fat of rams." And here says here in verse 23 some things that are really really hard to unravel a bit. Rebellion is as the sin of witchcraft. Stubbornness is as iniquity and idolatry. And he says, because you rejected the word of the Lord, he has also rejected you from being king. To justify means to cleanse, to clear, or to make righteous. Anytime we seek to do that for ourselves, whether it is by comparing ourselves to others or in some other manner, we cannot justify ourselves. Not possible. The only source of our justification is the Passover day when Jesus Christ was crucified, and the blood of the Lamb put over the door. That will cleanse us. It will clear us. It will make us righteous. And that is the justification upon which we need to depend. Justification by comparison or justification by any other means is not going to do the job. Well, let's examine ourselves in this regard. I think everyone will have to look at the matter on their own. But let's all examine ourselves in this regard. And in other regards as well. As we approach the days of unleavened bread, we should be getting this leavening out of our lives before we reach that point. And let's do that whenever we discover leaven that we have.